Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That was, of course, the voice of our founder, the Master of Mirth, among many other titles that he had, Brian Brown, who passed away nearly a year ago now. Life just isn't the same without Brian, but I'm ever so grateful for his friendship and who he was, everything that he brought to life, to his island, to his friends, to this station. This is the Brown Briefly, and I'm your host today, Michael Shook. And we have the usual gang of, the usual gang of intelligent, thoughtful people here.
Yeah.
The Brown Brieflies. We have on board Kevin Jones, the indefatigable Kevin Jones, who is a man who relentlessly and indefatigably marches forward to do what he can to help us keep our elections safe and secure and to activate the progressive gene that lies dormant in so many of us. Kevin, what's going on that you can tell us about the Georgia elections? They are voting today.
They're voting today. Polls are open and close at 7 p.m. I'm texting voters in Georgia right now, actually, to tell you the truth.
Holy cow.
I am texting, yeah, voters right now. So on with the group that we're texting with, Stacey Abrams joined us over the weekend and talked about how powerful it is to talk to Georgians who felt so disenfranchised for years about the power of their vote and the example of them collectively electing a president who will really align with their values in Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. And the polls are always suspect. There's hope, but it will be very close. And we shouldn't expect to hear results until Thursday, but Georgia's getting really good now at counting votes. So maybe it'll happen soon.
No massive voter fraud there, I take it.
It's undetectable so far.
Goodness. That was a. I think we're seeing the throes of a desperately cornered rat trying any means, of course, to hang on. I don't even need to say the person's name. We all know who that is. So, moving on to our peripatetic poet and an author. Dare I say futurist? Is that the appropriate term? Gail Kellner, who joins us from, I think, the West Side. Is that correct?
Yes. This morning, my rowboat is just offshore on Colmos Passage, waiting out the winter and the pandemic. Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks, Michael.
Well, we're glad to have you. Yes. And we have with us as well the former shortstop all-star, as many folks are aware, of the Dixie Debutantes, and former social worker and professor at UW in that same area, a woman not to be denied her voice, Lynn Kerrigan. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning, Michael. Well, that was a backhanded compliment if ever I heard one. Should I be quiet for the rest of the show? No, I will not. I have to add Kevin's discussion about Georgia for just a minute, since that's my old hometown, to say how proud I am of them. There were 3 million early voting votes already put in Georgia, which made me really happy. They are standing tall and proud, regardless of Trump's insane and probably criminal call to their election manager, Raffensperger, And, you know, I am proud of him. That man stood up against him and told Trump, the way not enough people have done, that his data was wrong. Mm-hmm. And I just love that. Last thing I'll say was that I caught Mary Trump on CNN last night. She was on Chris Cuomo's.
Now, that's his sister, right?
That's his niece. She's written the book, Too Much and Never Enough, who said that she thought all of this behavior on his part was not that he was insane and didn't know what he was doing, but that he was that fearful of going to jail for his loans are coming due, his prosecutions are going to be coming up the minute he's out of office. And she said he just cannot face that.
Yeah. I've wondered about that too, because he might be crazy, to not to put too fine a point on it, but he's also very canny. And I've wondered if a lot of this isn't a desperate attempt to try to raise as much money as possible.
Yes, that
try
too.
To pay some of those debts and cover some legal bills. That's an interesting thing. And I like what you brought up about Raffensperger. His, as you said, I've longed for a reporter. And I think some reporters have done this, but I've longed for the last 4 years for someone to just simply say, as Raffensperger did, respectfully toward the office of the president. And that's why, of course, why they say respectfully, Mr. President, but you're wrong.
Yes.
You know, just boom, flat out. Sorry, but your data is wrong. It's all false, et cetera. So that is refreshing.
I think people have tried to do that and he's fired them. He prefers sycophants.
Oh, sure. And then we also have down in the corner of my screen here, joining us from the east side, the radical outpost of Ellisport. And actually, that's where Lynn is too. I shouldn't reveal too much here. A radical outpost of Ellisport. We have Bruce Hallman, our guardian of the galaxy and historian who keeps us on track, especially me, because I can get a little wild sometimes with my dates and things. Good morning, Bruce.
Just don't reveal where we live, okay?
you don't want the graffiti on your door.
That's right.
Oh my God!
It's the armed crowds in the street with that's burning right. torches that I worry about.
Right? Fortunately, I think we're safe from most of that here. Goodness, and lastly, but not least, certainly is the Truman Tex O'Brien, late of the Western Prairies of Texas and the Wilderlands of Montana, who has wandered all over the globe, I think, with Alaska Airlines, and who now commands the control console there in the Gene Bosch Studios in tranquil and lovely downtown fashion. Yep. Welcome, Truman.
Right here watching the folks walk by. Hey, I have to tell you, you guys are always asking me about my right-wing buddies that I always report on from the Facebook right. and other. Well, I have a new one for you. This one is absolutely brilliant. So I'm also belong to a group that has a bunch of retired and active airline pilots, right? And it's the Pilots Against Trump. I mean, these guys, they do not like Trump at all. Anyway, one of my pals posted the whole thing about the phone conversation, right, between the Trump and the Secretary of State. And people are just jumping all over it. And what I put on there was, do you wonder if he sees himself as Vito Corleone or Tony Soprano?
Right. Exactly.
Exactly. And one of my other buddies said, well, actually, he's Fredo. So those of you who know The Godfather,
that's a
classic
equip there. But I'm certain, fairly certain that he wishes very much, of course, that he were Don Corleone.
Yeah, instead of Fredo.
But, yes.
I thought somebody said it was, somebody needs to take him fishing.
Oh, no. I don't think you can say that, Truman.
Well, no, that's what somebody else said. I didn't say that. Somebody else said it, but I thought it was pretty funny.
Truman is learning from Trump exactly how to walk the line threats and actionable speech innuendo.
I'm just retweeting what somebody else
Kevin,
said.
What, and then Bruce. What?
Well, I can't remember quite where this topic lies in our plan for the day, but we're here. It just exposes so much that we either implied or already knew, but now it's laid out in such detail, right? As I'm listening to the highlights, if you will, of that phone call, I'm thinking what it must be like to work in a Trump organization and get that kind of constant pressure all the time, and just present company excluded. But this notion of white entitlement that just says it's all, I take what I want and I don't have to ask forgiveness and I don't need to ask permission, is so blatantly displayed in that discussion. It just hits me that way. And of course, we have been working so hard to move beyond that with rights extend across gender lines, across religious lines, across cultural lines. And it's just a clear display to me that that's just where his mind and his life is. And it's in the past, and we need to put it behind us.
Bruce, what did you?
Well, it was just interesting. Last night on two different news programs, they had two different federal prosecutors talking about the phone call. And these are guys who have spent their whole career, pursuing mob bosses and pursuing the mafia. And they both said, independent of each other, these were two different programs. They both said, listening to that Trump phone call was just like listening to hours and hours of tapped phone calls between mafia members. It's all this sort of personal appeal and appeal to power, and you're going to be in trouble if you don't do this. And I mean, it's just amazing, that folks who work in that mafia world and who are trying to prosecute that mafia world see the parallels very, very clearly.
Yeah, that's it's an interesting thing. Kevin, your comment about the working, having to work in an environment like that. I think obviously we've seen the results of that in the extraordinarily unprecedented turnover rate of people in that administration, and some really good people who were working, I think, very hard. Now it's come out more and more to try to keep the ship of state at least somehow on track. But I'm even reading things in the National Review email that I get, because I wanted to hear what they were doing. And the last month has been a steady diet of opinion pieces and journalistic pieces laying out how bad a lot of this has become. So that's something that they're going in the direction that they are. What were you going to add there, Kevin?
Well, and not everybody has an opportunity to choose who they work for. But I've had that luxury, I would say. And there's some decisions that I made, which I'm happy to have made. And certain personalities, which are going to ask you to basically go beyond your comfort zone or your morals. And nothing like what we see in that phone call. But I think it's important that we try to carry with us, right, the morals and to the extent we can, because like I say, we don't always have a choice. But those little choices where we have them, I think, matter in the long haul. Mm-hmm. So it's just another observation.
That's a good observation there.
I can tell you that as a professional pilot, this is before my airline career, by the way, but when I was flying charter and all that kind of stuff, I can't tell you how many times I've had bosses or people over me say, you really need to take this flight. You really need to go this way or do this. And I I was old enough and cranky enough that I would say, no, I'm not doing that. This is the way we're going to do it, and that's just the way it is. But I know a number of young pilots who did not have that background, and they were killed. You know, everyone was lost because they did what they were told to do. So anyway, I'm with you, Kevin. I'm very, very respectful of those folks who say no, you know, that this is the way it has to be.
Lynn.
You know, I was, I had the privilege of working in some very hard work environments, not quite like the White House, but Harbor View Trauma Center was quite the intense place with lawyers calling you all the time and trying to get you to say things that you shouldn't on the phone. And I had a supervisor there who said that the way she maintained her moral compass and told everybody else to maintain theirs was to come to work every day prepared to be fired. In other words, to stand on your principles every day. If you know you were right, stand for them. And you may be fired. I never was. But it was an important moral lesson that in everyday lives, you know, we are faced with the choices of whether to go down to someone else's possibly unethical or illegal instructions, not to mention your own health and safety, or whether to stand up and do what you know to be right. And that served me well.
Yeah. Gail.
I'd just like to add in, I really appreciate all of you mentioning that not everyone has a choice about who they work for, and do not always have the power to stand up. And if they do, they are subject to losing their jobs. In particular, I think that happens with people of color that have little power or places to turn. I think it happens to women regularly that if you choose to stand up against whatever male, generally in my life and career experience, have been male-dominated systems, you can and will you lose your job. And I've had, this won't surprise Sterling, I have had that happen to me because I have not been willing to sit on my hands around things that I see as not right.
Yeah, boy, that kind of makes a good opening here to what I wrote earlier to you folks, which I forgot to print out. So I'm freewheeling here. But Heather Cox Richardson, who our listener may know by name, is a historian at I believe, Boston College. She taught at MIT. She's written 6 books. She's a pretty astute observer of things. And in her column, year-ending column, Letters to from an American, she spoke to many, many different topics. It was an excellent, very rich column. And Bruce, in a comment that he sent around, kind of succinctly captured the notion of that it was a snapshot, and I'm paraphrasing here, Bruce, but it's sort of a snapshot of what kind of country do we want to live in? And it's been this sort of 100-year struggle, and maybe longer than that, to what kind of a nation do we want to inhabit? And that played into when I read the Sunday paper headline in the Seattle Times of Amazon passes Boeing as the state's biggest employer. And I'm getting around to tying this in with what you just said, Gail, because Boeing here, for many, many years has been a stalwart in this area. And they used to have about a 60% union membership, which is enough that 30% that's not unionized is going to enjoy the benefits of those other 60%ers. And the protections that you're talking about that you didn't have, Gail, and that many, many people in low wage, high turnover jobs without benefits, without any union representation, there's no recourse oftentimes. And oftentimes, those are the folks who, of course, need that job the most. really, it's not like, well, I'll just get a different job next week. It's like, geez, no, I got to get some groceries on the table here. And that's where I was troubled by to see that Amazon, and I have nothing personal against Jeff Bezos or anything like that, but is now the largest employer in this area. And they have, like many other large corporations like that, done their darndest to keep unions out of their warehouses. And they have a high injury rate. They have burnout like crazy. It's kind of a struggle between those two forces. Lynn, what do you think? What's on
Michael,
your mind?
Michael, I so appreciated when you sent that out. And one of the things you said that I want to comment on in your advance letter to us last night, you said that, you know, we've become a society no longer based on making things, but on buying things and on consuming things, even information and all of that, like Amazon does. And it made me think about, you know, this long hundreds of years struggle between, you know, the white Puritan settlers who came here early on a long time ago and set up a system of labor in which people of color were exploited for their labor, shipped in and then exploited or destroyed if they were in the white man's way. And I think that this transition that we're also in, not just the globalization, but we're also in the period where people are standing up who are people of color saying we will not be exploited for our labor anymore without a share in the pie. And mm-hmm. So we're fighting also over, you know, this sharing of the resources with people that are actually doing the work, and hearing that slapped down over and over again as socialism. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to get a little more sophisticated in how we think about how our engine of the economy works and how we can be fair to people who do backbreaking labor all their lives who want to share the pie. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. where it seems like we are.
And Gail, just a second there. I want to, what you said about backbreaking labor too. Oftentimes we think of that kind of labor as, I don't know, the thing that comes to mind is on the railroad or something, or certainly the kind of work I've done in my life, logging and sawmill work and construction and stuff. But and there's a tendency to downplay or forget how hard janitorial work is.
That's right.
The people who are working lousy shifts in office buildings and warehouses and schools and everything year round, and cleaning houses, cleaning hotel rooms, all of that kind of stuff, are at the bottom of that wage scale. And that, man, anybody who's ever cleaned anything, I was a janitor for a couple of years in my youth. It's hard work. Mm-hmm. And if you do that for 20 or 30 years, man, it wears you down. Yeah. And where are the benefits? Where's the retirement for those kinds of folks? And people say, well, just put some money aside. Well, how can you do that when you're making a minimum wage? So, Gail, what? I hope I didn't derail you too much there.
No, it's I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's one of those issues that is little understood by white collar workers, and that is the physical toll of blue collar labor on the body, and what that the need for unions for things like pensions and protection of wages in the event of injury. And much of that has been disassembled after, you know, we were talking about 100-year look back. And I think that it's very interesting to see it from a 100-year perspective. I really appreciated Heather Cox Richardson's analysis in that way, seeing much of what the world looks like today as an outcome of Reconstruction after slavery ended after the Civil War, its reaction to it, the rise of workers, and the rise of the New Deal that began to address some of the social issues in our country and in the 1930s and on into the 40s. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting because it has been an undoing of that since the beginning of the Reagan era, and that that is, you know, it's fascinating and also deeply disturbing. And I'll make one last comment. Although women and people of color and various sexual orientations have gained some power, more than anything, they've gained recognition. And mm-hmm. that is the big plus side and the what gives me hope.
Is that kind of, maybe that's kind of one of the first steps to saying, hey, we're here. I recall the history of the labor. Well, let's go back to about 1920, if we go back 100 years, and the suffragettes had spent years making themselves visible. And I know some of them, you know, they were thrown in jail. They were clubbed more than once. And seen as awful rabble rousers, but they persevered and got that vote. And then the labor movement there had to pick up some of that too. I remember in the reading about in the 20s and the Dust Bowl and everything, farmers en masse descending on various state capitals and even Washington, D.C., I think, to make themselves seen, to say we're not going to be seen anymore. So how do we go forward from that? Well, go ahead, Gail.
Just one quick comment, because I'd like some other people to jump in on this. But the Black Lives Matter is essentially a message of see me. Mm-hmm. Recognize that I exist. Recognize that my life is as meaningful and nuanced and full of pain, suffering, love as any other life. And it's and so I think that deep down, the message is often the same. It's Black lives matter, workers' lives matter, women's lives matter, immigrant lives matter. It's very easy to other people. And once we do that, or the main people in power that have traditionally been white men, and not speaking ill of anyone in particular, but just that's the power structure that we've lived under. And if you other everybody else, they don't have feelings, they don't have experiences that are valid, it's very easy to oppress them and take away their rights or not care about even their lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kevin, did you have something you wanted to add there?
This kind of goes back to the employment. The shift from Boeing to Amazon, and it's kind of intriguing that, you know, I was a manager at the Boeing company when they had the largest white collar strike in the country, and the SPIA walked out. And it was really intriguing to listen to managers talk about how organized the engineers were in this strike. It's sort of like, you got to kind of give them credit for being, you know, pretty organized. They're engineers. but it was just this sort of startling lack of awareness, right, of how really capable a group of people who are these white collar professionals could be in a strike. And now, of course, what we see is Boeing moving their production facilities over the decades to South Carolina. The program that I retired from is now located in Oklahoma. And so those are right to work states.
Mm-hmm.
There's no union actions there. And so what we have, interestingly, there's still a retention of this, you know, engineering design development that's here in the Northwest, because there's this huge intellectual property that exists here. But the rest of the tiers of labor are now exported out of Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this now division that could potentially come from that. I haven't really thought about it much other than the discussion we're having here right now, but this notion about how labor treats the communities that really are the wherewithal of their ability to produce and reap the rewards that they gain, mm-hmm. is clearly an important thing for us to consider in how we go forward.
Yeah. Bruce, I want to get your input on this too, but one of the things that your comment about things going to South Carolina and other out of Washington State reminded me of, Kevin, is that I cannot remember the name of the airline, but they said this was about 5 years ago, and they said, we're happy to buy planes from you, Boeing, but we want the ones that are built in Everett. We will not take delivery of your planes that are made in South Carolina.
They were actually want to buy the satellites that you build in Seattle and not the ones you build in California. I mean, yeah, seriously, yeah. Very true.
Bruce, what think ye?
Well, yeah, I mean, this discussion's fascinating because this, like Gail pointed out, I mean, it's that sort of drive to be seen. And part of that drive to be seen is to be recognized and to be rewarded for what you bring to the table, in effect. And that has been a struggle that's been going on, you know, for 150 years from the Civil War and Reconstruction, you know, through the populist, the farmers movement and the labor movement, the women's movement, into the civil rights movement, into the LGBTQ plus movement, into the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, it's a continuing stream in American history of pushing against the restrictions that a patriarchal, racially based society brings. And that's not to condemn who we are. I mean, we are who we are as a country, and we have a history that we have to recognize, but we have a history that we can also change. And that's really the struggle that we see going on right now. And that's at the core of the division of America right now between, progressives and I don't want to call them conservatives, because true conservatives, and you're starting to see that in the Republican Party, the true conservatives are not backing Trump. It's this sort of radical right-wing nutcase kind of group who call themselves Republicans that are going to lose the Republican Party that are backing Trump right now. Truman?
Yeah, I just want to say that we have in the studio, getting ready for her show coming up, is Susan McCabe from Real Talk, and she is chomping at the bit. She wants to jump in here if you guys will let her.
So. You're always welcome, Susan.
Susan.
And I always have an opinion. Thank you for allowing me. I always love you guys' conversations.
Happy to have you.
He's Zoom bombing us.
And nice haircut, Kevin.
I'm going to say that.
How I am listening to you guys talk about how individual groups in our society are seeking recognition. And I just read an article that was totally stunning to me that brought it way down to the basics, saying that we are living under the tenets of capitalism, and capitalism only values those things that are worth money. And what capitalism does is turn life into money. And what we need to do in this culture is go back to turning money into life.
It reminds me of something that I read in one of the first books that I read by Eric Fromm, and he wrote this one back in the late 40s, early 50s, and he had a statement in there. And of course, let's acknowledge up front that Fromm was a Marxist, but of a peculiar and interesting stripe. He was very much a humanist as well. But he said, he made the point that you just did, Susan, that he said, capital, which is dead, commands labor, which is alive. And I think what you brought up is a really good point. When we can make capital our servant, that's a great relationship. But when capital commands us, it winds up destroying communities. And we've seen that with Boeing. I feared this happening with Boeing when the company was taken over and they moved the headquarters to Chicago. And I felt like to remove a company from the community that it has nurtured, but that in turn the community has nurtured that company and provided it with the employees and with the stability and the pride to make a really good product. Now that's gone, and we're just employees, and we're managed by somebody thousands of miles away. Gail.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I believe that small scale capitalism has a place in our society, but I will say that corporate capitalism is another thing, another beast altogether, and that Marx actually believed that capitalism would die of its own accord, that it simply would eat up the people involved and they would revolt. And in many ways, we are seeing that. What he didn't foresee is that it would take such a toll on the environment that the environment would actually collapse under the weight of capitalism. But he foresaw people collapsing under the weight of capitalism. And of course, to push back against that is, you know, are things like unions, are things like the rights of nature, there are ways to have that not be the case, but we are facing some of that right now.
Mm-hmm. Lynn.
I want to agree with that and take it a step further, because we are living under an unregulated capitalism. It has been in the past more regulated and put to human needs. And in fact, our own form of government, social democracy, is a middle ground between capitalism that just sends all the profits to the top under that kind of an economy, mm-hmm. versus the idea of government which can see to it that the commonwealth is taken care of, that we're providing for our defense and our general welfare. That mm-hmm. is in our Constitution, that we are going to try to find this middle ground between anarchy that we're seeing a little bit now and the kind of drive for just money. So I just want to say to anybody who's listening who has swallowed the Republicans' long years of lying about, when you talk about wanting people to have a share of the pie, that's communism or it's socialism. And I will go to my deathbed saying it is not. We mm-hmm. are trying to make happen a social democracy, mm-hmm. which means the government is going to see to it that its people have a fair shot at a happy life. Mm-hmm. And we are way overdue for getting that done. And in terms of Black people, I think one of the things I just want to say is we've got to stop shooting them. We're afraid of them, and we've got to stop shooting them, period.
That's a good thing to come back to. Bruce, what did you have in there?
I just wanted to pick up, and it sort of feeds into what Lynn was just talking about. When the 737 MAX issue came up, there's a fascinating article in the Seattle Times. A reporter was looking at what had changed in the Boeing culture. Mm-hmm. And she sort of characterized it as a conflict between the Boy Scouts and the Sharks. And the Boy Scouts were the old Boeing management style, engineer-based, always, Seattle-based, always sort of looking at not only the good of the company, but the good of the employees and the good of the product. Mm-hmm. And she saw in the 1990s, early 2000s, the shift away from that in Boeing management toward the MBA Sharks, mm-hmm. who were looking just at the bottom line, mm-hmm. and who were willing to make decisions that didn't benefit necessarily the company or the employees, but benefited the bottom line of the investors, stockholders. And that is what led to the 737 MAX crisis.
Amen, brother.
Kevin, you can talk more about that. But that also fits into what Lynn and Gail were both saying about how you can't focus on just the bottom line. Mm-hmm. You can't focus on just the good of the stockholders, because a company, a corporation, a small business is much more than that. It's much more than the investors. It's the employees, it's the product, it's the community, and it's the people who consume that product.
Absolutely. Yeah, Kevin.
Right.
Well, I'll just say that I worked in the aerospace part of the Boeing company, and it was intriguing that at one time we did that operation where we were now managed from people who were, you know, several hundred miles away. And one of the new managers came to visit and toured our facility, and we were giving them the tour of the labs and so on. And the manager puts his hands on a piece of space qualified hardware, and he looks up at me. He's written, you know, on a rack. He's sort of down, squatting down. He looks up at me and says, "I mean, this is really going to fly in space?" And I thought immediately, well, yes, number one. And number two, as it was apparent to me, he had never laid eyes on or even understood the contents or the process to get from thought through manufacturing to qualification of something that could fly on a satellite. And it was like, this is going to be an interesting future. And it was not good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It happened.
Boy,
can I say that there's a couple of things I think it's really important for us to remember is that what we're talking about now are the result of policy changes, which happened mm-hmm. in the 80s, which can be changed again if yes. we had the political will to do it. One yes. of them was the 80s era financial policy that shifted a corporation's responsibility from consumer safety to the shareholders getting their investment back. And that's what happened when all of a sudden the sharks hit the ground mm-hmm. because the mm-hmm. only measure of their success was shareholder profits.
Yeah.
The second one was Citizens United, which has put piles of money in political campaigns from corporations. Both of those need to be overturned.
Yeah, and untrackable, you can just dump it in there and it's used for whatever. Truman, what do you have to say there?
I got one quick thing, and that is I'm very opinionated about the whole Max thing. And I can tell you that not only, I mean, I appreciate everything you've said about the culture and all of that, but it comes down to the guys sitting in the front seat. And those guys, it was either the training or the experience, or it was the lowering of the bar of the qualifications of the people driving the jet that caused those accidents. I mean, mm-hmm. bottom line, they should have been able to fix that on their own. They should have been able to do it. We were trained to do it. American pilots had that very same thing happened to them. They shut it off and just flew the jet. These yeah. guys did not have the background to do that. Their co-pilot in the Nigerian one only had 300 hours. 300 hours. Wow. He doesn't know his behind from straight up, I can tell you. And yeah. and so I completely get the corporate culture and the sharks and all of that. But down to the bottom line, the guys in the front seat should have been able to do that.
Gail, thank you, Truman.
I don't want to jump topics too much. And Kevin, is your thought directly related?
I'm just going to say, I don't disagree at all, Truman, with what you're saying. But I can tell you that as a design engineer, you know, we are trying to look at the entire system.
Sure.
And there are clearly a bell curve of talent and experience in the people who fly the airplanes.
Clearly.
And there's a bell curve of corporations who train them and establish the criteria. And so it's a matter now of looking at where you allocate the risk, right? Who mm-hmm. takes up the slack when something doesn't work? Yeah. And it varies. So it's not a simple problem. It is complex. And clearly, you know, we had some pretty catastrophic changes, which hopefully will make things safer. Did it go too far? Did the pendulum swing too far? Perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Let me jump in here real quick. We've just got a few seconds left. Thanks to our listener for joining in, and thanks for everyone's contributions. I see this whole thing as let's all go forward together. Unions, Black Lives Matter, women's movements, LGBTQ+. Now is the time here we can unite. We can change these things. As you pointed out very aptly, Lynn, legislation can be reversed. And it can get back to something where the common wheel is taken into account. And there's plenty for all of us to prosper. All of us can prosper.
Let's bring along those blue collar workers with us too.
Absolutely. Yeah, just the pie can be big.
And good luck in Georgia.
See you all next week.